What a way to start with some tears, but that's how it goes in the program sometimes. Just set an alarm that will be close to the end because I've actually never spoken for, this is my second time speaking. I spoke last year for 10 minutes, and so speaking for an hour was a real honor to be asked. It's a real privilege to be recognized in that way and to be asked to speak. And so I thank the committee, all the committee members for their warm greeting today, for the great room that I'm in, and for your love and support of my journey to serenity. And I love this opportunity to reflect on my journey so far. It's a real blessing to be in this program. As I said, I spoke last year for 10 minutes and I was very nervous, and I had it all written down. I had typed it out and I read off of a sheet of paper. And my journey in the last year has taken me to different places where that's not what I'm doing tonight, that I'm not that same person today as I was a year ago. That was, you know, fear, because of course there's a very, I'm very anxious, and there's a fear to talk, to trust, and to feel when we're taught not to talk, not to trust, and not to feel. And so it's, you know, letting go of my ego, getting in right relationship with my higher power, and believing that my faith will bring me through this and that my higher power will speak through me. And so when I'm, you know, shaking a little bit, or when I'm angry, or when I have something that doesn't sit right with me, what I do is something that a sponsor taught me, and that is working the 12 steps. I stand up here because I honestly believe that they are spiritual tools, and that working the steps is what has me feeling good about myself today. So this has changed my life. At one time, I thought the steps were just mechanical. You know, we read them at meetings. I read them off of cards, and now it's just become a part of who I am. And so they've really evolved for me. They're not mechanical. They're spiritual for me, and they're what bring me peace and serenity, which is, you know, my goal in my life. So I'm starting with step one. I'm powerless over what everyone thinks of me here, and my life is unmanageable, because I, you know, I'm afraid. And step two, I believe in a higher power that will restore me to sanity right in this moment. And step three, I turn my will and my life over. I surrender that right now, because in surrendering, I know I get the peace that I need. Step four, well, that fear, that fear has been there all my life, because I have been a people pleaser and a person who tried to get people to like me and did almost everything to try to fit into whatever that mold was that people wanted me to be, so that I would get acceptance and approval, because the biggest thing I didn't want was rejection, because of course I experienced rejection as a child, and that didn't feel so good. So, you know, put on my suit of armor and gear up. And so, yeah, so there's fear, as I said. No resentments, no anger. I harm myself for sure when I take a self-centered approach to my life, and I like to take the God-centered approach. So that is, for me, I can take this self-centered approach, and I can rely on my intellect and my ego, or I can follow a God-centered life and suffer the consequences of that, and I definitely prefer that in my life. All right, so I've shared with you, so that's step five. Step six, I'm entirely ready. Yeah, I don't want this fear in me right now. You know, it'll keep me from trusting my higher power and doing this 12-step work that I've been privileged to ask to do tonight. Step seven, yes, humbly, I'm in relationship with my God right now, my higher power. I'm not trying to play God, so yeah, I admit that right now. Step eight, okay, nine. Nine for me has evolved as well. It's just kind of, for me, it's acknowledging that, you know, I'm a child of God. I am a spiritual being, and that I'm in right relationship with the people in this room, and I'm not trying to control or change anyone in this room or fix anyone. Step 10, yes, I'm taking personal inventory right now, because I, you know, I'm still shaking a little. step 11 for me, prayer and meditation. You know, I spent time with those things for myself today and right before I came down stairs to speak to you. And step 12 for me is this, sharing the 12-step work and carrying the message in the honor of that. So thank you. That's what I do. I have the privilege of being in the program with a family member, my mom. And so when we are having an issue in our gut, we check our gut and we're not doing good. You know, we do that together, whatever it is, and we hash it out. And for me, it has changed my life. My sponsor, you know, when I'd call and I'd say I'd have an issue, she'd be like, yeah, have you done the 12 steps yet? Call me when you have. So that was really helpful for me. It was either that or a Dear God letter. And so the 12 steps have really worked for me because I actually get to speak my anger, speak my resentment and get it out so that it's not stuck in me. All right, so now, I guess what I want to say before I start sharing a little bit about who I am and what it was like for me is that I'm a product of my experience of, you know, the speakers that I've heard share. I haven't been at a meeting with everyone in this room, but I know that everyone who I've heard speak has, I can identify with them in some way. So the things that I say aren't things that come from my intellect. They're ideas that have been discovered that are already out there. And for me, they're things that, you know, I've just been privileged to uncover in my recovery. Okay, so I came into this world in a home of recovery. My mom was 3 months pregnant with me when she went into recovery, which was such a blessing. And my father, who I have only met once in my life and he's passed on, I identify him as an alcoholic. He never identified that for himself, but for me, I identify him as that. And so so I was born a product of an affair between two alcoholics. My father was married and 17 years older than my mother. And in a power position where they worked together and she was younger, she was 20. So to start off, I was a recovery baby. I sat at the tables of AA when my mom was in recovery. She has her big book from 35 years ago. Now you know how old I am. And she has the big book and I practiced writing my name in it. So it's a real treasure because I guess at the meetings, I probably wasn't spiritually in tune with what was going on. So I had opportunity to write in her big book. And as I said, that's a real treasure. I also have had great experiences of attending social events, AA social events. So there's a picture of me dancing with an AA member or AA members because it was a real family get together. Like the AA logo was on the floor. Here I am dancing. I'm like 3 or 4 years old. And it was just something that, you know, it's a nice memory to have and to have the pictures captured there. So kind of what happened is my father wasn't really in my life. So my mother was a single mother, and I'm very passionate about early childhood development. So I have a lot of gratitude for the work that my mom did with me as a youngster, teaching me to read and just engaging with me. And there's pictures of me punching bundo and washing the dishes. And like my mom had stools for me. She had me up there doing things and she treated me like a human being and she loved me. And I have lots of good memories like of healthy, normal things where it's like every Saturday we would clean. And you know, there was just health in our lives and there was a lot of love. Unfortunately, that changed at age 4. My mom met a person who was in the AA fellowship. And that person and my mom decided that they would blend their families together. And what that was like for me is I was an only child living with my mom, who I loved very much, and you know, had that support and security. And this man came from an alcoholic home. He, you know, in my opinion, wasn't really working his program, and also brought 3 children from his previous relationship, his marriage. So I became one of 4 in a home. And And so that was hard because I was forced to share. And yes, we need to learn those lessons, but when it's done in a mean way, it's very hurtful. I was also violated at 2 years old. I experienced sexual abuse from my cousin, who was also a child. He had been abused by a neighbor at his grandparents' lake. And so at 2 or 3 years old, I remember that I was also violated. And so that, you know, sucked a lot out of me. And I had a lot of shame. I didn't understand it. Of course, I'm 3 or 4 years old. And then it also, you know, it made me, you know, fear, not trust, want to control things. So it was very hard going into that blended family, not sharing this secret, right? Because I have shame. So I have this toxic shame that's eating away at me very young. And then I come into this family where this man, my mom's ex-boyfriend, he would, he thought that tickling was fun, and for me that wasn't. And so that was a violation of my physical self and my physical body, so that was something that made me very uncomfortable. And then also he controlled everything I said or did, and you know, everything from eating a meal and having to eat it right to not allowed to use the channel changer to touch the TV, to turn on the TV. So everything was criticized, and my mom recently shared with me that maybe I was 5 or 6, we were visiting some family and I was sitting on my grandma's knee, so my maternal grandmother. And this was maybe one of the first times that this man was with our family. And I spoke up because he had said something to me that, you know, he treated me the way that he treated me at home. He didn't have a filter in front of my family. And he said to me something like, well, I can't remember the exact words, but the nature of it was like, he was telling me something that I needed to do. And I said to him, I don't like the way that you talk to me. So that was really freeing for me to hear just a few weeks ago, because it helped me recognize that I did have a sense of self, that I wasn't completely hidden away from, you know, the trauma that I experienced as a child. And so, yeah, that was a powerful thing to hear now. And I'm glad that I heard it now, because it made me see. But I guess later, my mom told me afterwards, like 3 weeks later, this man couldn't let go of the fact that I had stood up to him in front of this family. And he was even asking a coworker, like, children should just be heard and not, or should be seen and not heard. And so he, you know, was really trying to justify and defend why he acted the way he did. And so that was our home life. And unfortunately, it was like that for 7 years. My mom was in that relationship. We did leave that relationship at certain times. We were in a women's shelter at one point. We moved in with friends. My mom did keep in contact with people in recovery. And then what was also happening at that time is we were moving a lot. And I don't know if you're aware of transient families and transient kids, but there's a lot of fear when you have to go and move to a new school and when you're not part of, you know, a community and growing up in that community. So yeah, it was really hard to move to new schools. I know we moved several times, and maybe when I was in my 20s, we had moved about 30 times in my life, so it was a lot. And yeah, so that has an impact on me as well. So kind of the end of that relationship, I have to say I love cats. I love cats so much that that my grandma, my maternal grandmother, rescued this cat. We were living in Alberta at the time, and rescued this cat and brought it to our house. And my my mom, you know, had some divine connection at that point, and he said, it's me or the cat, and she said, it's the cat. So he was gone, not permanently. Like, he did come back for a little bit, but after that, he was gone. And that was great because it was like, okay, yay, the cat. And so So that cat was in my life till 2006, and it meant a lot to me, and I'll tell you about my cat stuff later. But anyway, that cat did mean a lot to me and moved a few different places with me, and unfortunately died here in Saskatchewan after we moved back here. So anyway, but love of my life for sure. Because, you know, as a child, you want to be rescued from those homes that are dysfunctional. So if it's a cat, I'll take it. So anyway, yes, so of course there were effects of the disease. What happened was we moved in with my mom's sister and her two children. And so I was the eldest of the three children there. And so so as I said, I wanted to control. And so I controlled our play. So whether we were playing with Barbies or we were playing with, we had Nintendos and Segas then and stuff. It was like I really wanted to control the things around me because my life was so out of control. And so, you know, that impacted my two cousins who, you know, today I look at them as, you know, kind of like siblings because we did grow up together and that those are special bonds for me. But there's a, I have to say there's a dysfunctional family behind all of this because my maternal grandfather, he was an alcoholic. My grandma was actually the first person to go to Al-Anon in our family. She didn't stay in the program, sadly. And then other family members have also been involved. My mom's sisters have been involved. But when you have people that are untreated and living the disease, there is dysfunction. And so my teenage years, even though we weren't in that abusive family anymore, those teenage years were tough because there were things that were playing out among kind of my mom and her sister and my mom and her mom that were unresolved from childhood. And so so what happened was my aunt tried to take over the role of my mom because my mom was, you know, grieving and needing to work through her stuff after being in that relationship and examining why she was in that relationship. And, you know, that's her story to tell. But I won't get into that now. But it was hard because there was manipulation. There were, you know, there were fights. There were good times too, but, you know, it was hard. And I was a very good student, but and kind of, you know, knew that I liked school, even like really had a tough time, as I said, connecting with maybe my peers since we moved so many times. But I had I had an appreciation for this for school, and that's somewhere where I could do well. I could be a perfectionist, right? I could try to get my insides filled through my outsides. So trying to do all that I could through schoolwork. But at about age 16, 17, I hit a big wall. I had missed, you know, I had days or weeks where I would miss school throughout my childhood and my teenage years. But at 16, 17, like, it got very bad to the point where I would stay in my closet and I would scream and I would not want to go to school. And so for me, that was anxiety and depression. And as we know, that's a silent illness and it's not that well understood. And so my friends didn't really understand what was going on for me. But fortunately I was able to get some help with that. And that's when I got into a grief group, and I was able to reveal. I was in a safe group with other teenage women, and I was able to reveal the sexual abuse that had happened to me. So that was good to reveal one secret that I'd been carrying around for a long time. Then fast forwarding, I didn't finish school with my peers because I had missed quite a bit of school. But at that time, I found a love and a passion for teaching. And I had two great opportunities as I was able to take part in work experiences where I was in classrooms and was kind of like, I guess, what we'd call an educational assistant. But I was doing that as a teenager, as a volunteer. And that filled my cup. That made me feel good about myself, and it gave me something to get through high school. So as I said, I actually didn't get my diploma with my peers, and I was, you know, still struggling. I was going to counseling. I had things going on to try to help me through that. And then an opportunity came. My mother's godmother, she was a retired teacher. She lived here in Saskatchewan, and she invited me to come and visit her here. And so I came out to Saskatchewan, picked her up at the plane in Regina, and we went out to a small town in Saskatchewan where she lived, and found out that she was very sick. She had actually been at the Mayo Clinic, and she was very sick. And, you know, I didn't have a very strong relationship with her. I'd seen her a few times in my life. There's pictures of us spending Christmases together when I was young, but I didn't know her that well. But what came to happen is my mom and I moved in with her, and we became her caregivers. And she was given 3 months to live. And she lived for 18. And we took care of her in her home for 6. And it's hard to talk about because dealing with grief at 18 or 19 years old, when you have all your other stuff going on, and you know, you already feel ashamed that you didn't graduate and that you have gone through abuse and that, you know, you don't feel normal and all this stuff, it's sad, because this lady, I loved her so much, and she was the first person to just like love me unconditionally, and she saw something in me that, you know, not too many people had shared before. And, you know, she was just a blessing in my life. And when she passed away, I didn't expect that to happen. What was happening is, I guess I should kind of define how I see the disease of alcoholism, because I believe that alcoholism and the effects of it are life and death, whether you're the alcoholic or you're the Al-Anoner. it is that serious. I've seen it in the people around me. And so I needed to cope with the fact that she was dying, and that I didn't know how to handle that. And at this time, my mom and I weren't really on a communication level. We weren't, you know, sharing honestly and openly, because, you know, the disease is don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. And also, I was living in dishonesty. So, you know, I wasn't sharing how I was really doing or what I was thinking. So what happened is, I carry a lot of shame with this, but the night that she passed away, the hospital was trying to call us, and they couldn't get through because I had started talking to people and trying to connect with people in a chat room, and I was talking to a male my age that I had met online, and this was the first time I was talking to him on the phone. And so I talked to him all night, and they were trying to get through, and it wasn't until I hung up maybe at 5 or 6 or something in the morning that they were able to get through. And so there's a lot of shame with that, because we committed to be there with her. We committed to, you know, be with her in her end journey, and we weren't there, and we didn't realize, you know, I didn't know how it looks as a person is in their end of life stages. And so the last time that I saw her, you know, I'll reveal what Phyllis said about one of my talents. I sang with her. I sang to her, and I read to her, and I didn't know that that would be the last time that I would see her. So it was very hard. But the blessing of that was I was in a community that that accepted me 100%. I have to say that, you know, a small town, rural community in Saskatchewan, I felt a sense of belonging kind of for the first time in that place, and it meant a lot to me. My mother's godmother's friends, who were all kind of like in their 70s, 80s, 90s, they adopted us, and, you know, they had us over for dinners. And I remember we celebrated my birthday. We'd been there only 3 months, and I had more birthday cards than I'd ever had in my life. It was like, it was the most awesome thing. So, and I was connecting with people who genuinely wanted to be in my life, and it was a safe place for me because these people, you know, they were just real. And it just made a difference in my life. So kind of fast forwarding a bit more. I didn't really have a relationship with a higher power. I know we had gone to church on and off in my life. I'd also hooked up with a group of friends when we were kind of permanently in one place when I was a teenager, and they were youth group goers. So I got in with some youth group, but my idea of a higher power was that my higher power was letting bad things happen to people, and I didn't know why. And so some people say that that's like seeing your higher power as a punishing God. It was, I couldn't understand. I couldn't understand my higher power and the things going on in the world. And so it was kind of like an adversarial relationship. And at times I would, I might've learned a line of scripture and I would say that in my time of trouble when I really thought like, come on, you got to help me here. And it was just that kind of relationship. It wasn't really anything. But I did have like values in me, because as I said, I had, a really positive start to life, with that, the single mom relationship that I had with my mom in those beginning years. So I had it in the back of my mind that I wanted to practice abstinence. And so I'm talking about sex now. Yes. But it was hard because, there's temptation all around, and there's, I found that was a way to connect, but it became a dysfunctional love addiction for me. And I settled for sex when I really wanted love. And that was some of my life in my 20s, and it was hard and it was painful. And one of my sponsors said to me, it's like, imagine that you are paper dolls and you get together and then there's that glue. And then when you pull yourself apart, what happens? That stuff is still stuck, right? And so parts of them are still stuck to you. And it was, it has been a lot of work to do some healing from that, because I did things that I wasn't happy with. I knew that my mom had been part of an affair, and I didn't ever want to be adulterous, and I engaged in that. And that's something that I had to work through a lot of shame with, that because that's not someone that I thought that I would be. But the effects of the disease drive you to do those things. And okay, that's what I was getting to a little while ago. So I said that this disease is life or death, even for the Al-Anon people. And for me, the things that I've been driven to do, the ways that I've reacted to this disease, the things that I've been driven to do in this disease, I'm not proud of. I relate very much to the alcoholic, because in the AA Big Book, it says that alcohol is but a symptom. And for me, I have many symptoms. And whether it's a food addiction, whether it's numbing myself watching TV or Netflix, or numbing out on Facebook and comparing myself to other people. I know there are many more, and I didn't write them all down, but as we know, there are many things. And as I said, the love addiction and trying to get my needs met outside of myself. And so through this recovery process, I've learned that I've always had this dull ache, and what that feels like to me, I heard it described perfectly, so I use this word because it makes a lot of sense. It's an oceanic ache. And how that feels for me, I have felt that since I was a child, because that innocence was taken away. And I do believe that that we all have those moments where our innocence was taken away, and we've had, shame-filled moments, moments that have really hurt us to our core. And for me, I was trying to always fill that hole with things outside of myself. And I've said some of them, and I won't probably say everything that I've done tonight, but that was how I operated. It was just, whether it was with friends, it was people pleasing. And if they liked that, then I liked that. So I had a friend who in university who loved Sex and the City. And so then I got into that. But at the core of who I was, that wasn't something that I would actually choose to be involved with. Or I remember being teased by my younger cousins as a child because I wasn't interested in horror films, and I wasn't interested in swearing, and I wasn't interested in some of these things that they were using to act out their disease. And so, there was always, like, in the disease for me, there's always like an othering or a comparison or an inferiority feeling. And so that was hard because I always felt less than. I always felt like there's something wrong with me, and, you know, why did these things happen? And I was definitely living in a victim mentality. And so I had some experiences in university in my 20s where I was able to use my voice. And I think that's really important, something that I learned from a step study that I'm doing now, is that it's okay to set boundaries if you do it through anger and rage. And that was really helpful because it's not the best way to go about it, but if it works in that moment and it helps you because you didn't have that voice as a child and you didn't feel good about using your voice, then okay, get on that footing, and, you know, more will be revealed in time. You will figure something else out later. And so in university, I stood up for myself. I was... there was a person in the program that I was in, a professor, who didn't like me, and I didn't fit the cookie cutter shape at that time. I was, you know, just spreading myself thin. I was involved in this love addiction stuff. I was running for like student government. I was just doing all of this stuff, and I was, you know, trying to show how great I am and how much worth I have, and my grades were suffering. And there was a woman who decided that I was not a good fit for the program that I was in, which was teaching, and sent me an email and basically said, like, you should leave the program. And it was a big shock for me and hurtful. But fortunately, I had found my voice, and so I went to the student advocate, and I used my voice to stand up for myself. And I wasn't kicked out of the program, and that was a big deal for me at the time. I see it quite differently now. Like, I see it for what it was then, and I accept that. But the program has definitely taught me a different way. I don't have to, you know, that lady's not a nail, and I'm not a hammer, and I don't have to act that way all the time. And so, so there were other opportunities where I did stand up for myself, because I've also had lots of people ask me, "What are you?" And if you get that question, you know that that hurts. What it is it's people taking you at face value. They're looking at your physical characteristics, and they're wondering what your race is. And that's hurtful. It's not an easy thing to say, to answer. And I don't think it's an appropriate question to ask someone either. So there have been, you know, times where I felt discriminated against, for sure. And you know, it doesn't matter. I am a human being, right? Just like everyone in this room. So now, kind of leading up to what brought me to recovery a little bit, I live in Melville. I'm not a person who's lived there for very long. I moved there for a job. And as I said, I don't really identify anywhere as home because I moved around so many times. So for me, kind of home is, you know, where I'm standing right now. It's within me, and it's where I have peace and serenity. So that could be anywhere that I am, if it's out in the Duck Mountains with my mom, or somewhere in nature in the Capel Valley. That's where I feel kind of most connected to myself. Anyway, so I moved there for a job, and of course, I was untreated. I wasn't in the program. Yes, I was aware of AA. Fortunately, my mom, she instilled a belief in me that if I drank, I would likely end up an alcoholic, since I had my mother as an alcoholic, my father as an alcoholic, and my grandfather as an alcoholic. And so I was scared of alcohol. I really, didn't gravitate towards that. And that's probably why I picked up other things in my life. Although food addiction for sure was something that was just part of our family, because my grandma would make cinnamon buns to make my mom feel better. And that just carried on. There's I have a very strong love of baking from my grandma. And that's how she shows her love. So anyway, so as I said, I brought these defects into my job and my career, and a lot of shame, as I said, because I was really ashamed about, you know, how I had been in university, and, you know, I'd used people, I had, you know, not been authentic. I was really a false self. I was a toxic, shamed person, and I was hiding who I really was. And so my career suffered as a result of that. In my first year, someone that was above me in that role, who was like a supervisor to me, she must have saw that I was wearing a statement that said, "I am a victim and I am a target and you can bully me." So I experienced bullying for those first 2 years, and it continued. And one of the worst things that I experienced, and why I now believe that the school system is actually a shaming system, and that it's not mine to fix, was being called to a meeting. And luckily, I had learned that, you know, there are people that will help you in those meetings. And so I had someone from my union there to help me and advocate for me. And at that meeting, there were three people sitting across from me. And they were basically lying, but saying that your job is equivalent to how many children you have in your classroom. And that if you don't have full numbers, because I had to have 32 to have a full classroom, and that may not make sense to you. I was teaching pre-kindergarten, so there are 32 assigned spaces, and we get money from the government for that. And so if I didn't have 32 filled in those spaces, that I would lose my job. And in that moment, they were basically saying that, you know, we want to move you. We want you to consider some other grade. And I'd given my heart and soul to that program. It was like, I loved being in that classroom. I loved being with my mom, who I was joking with her this weekend. She's all about feng shui. She's all about interior decorating, and she's very good at it. And so she would come into my classroom and she'd make sure that things were straight and aligned. And I was like the intellectual one. Like, I had the ideas, but she had like the way to like make everything look good. And so we worked really well together. And so I really loved that time with her, because there was some healing time that came because she was there with me to do those things. And so she, so I'm sitting there and they're saying my job's dependent on this. And this was actually, I'd been in the program for a short amount of time, maybe about a year or maybe a few months actually. And I was divinely inspired in that moment. And, you know, I was working the steps at that time. I'd been to a women's retreat for women in recovery. I had some great people in my life who were supporting me and accepting me and loving me. And my silent reaction on the inside was like, I looked at the person, at each person individually, because they're talking and I'm just stunned, because I was not expecting this at all. And I knew it was serious. I knew that, you know, having three people in front of you is pretty serious. But, you know, silently I was saying, you know, light and love to your family, to your spouse, to your kids, whatever. And I was just sending that. And that was such a blessing for me, because it calmed me. Of course, I took a little break and I cried. And then we got back together. And in the end, their hearts were changed, and they did allow me to continue with that role, but shaming me and putting something on me that wasn't 100% my control. Like, I can't get every parent to come there and register their child. I mean, I can advertise, I can do everything. I can, you know, reach out to people and say, send them my way, but I can't do that. I am not in control of that. And it was an unreasonable expectation to put on me. And so in the end, the heartbreak for me, which happened in this last year, which was this last year has been so hard for me. And when I was asked to speak, it was like the second week of May. And I remember Phyllis calling me and saying, you know, we'd be honored to have you speak. And, you know, it really lifted me because at that time I was dealing with an illness and I had been on medical leave and I had a very small world. And it meant a lot to me to be asked and to be considered in that way. And it brought a lot of joy. And I felt like myself for the first time in many months. But the next week, I received a phone call and an email saying, please come in for a meeting. And at that point, I wasn't up to any form of confrontation, any type of meeting. I knew that, you know, something was going on and I didn't want to go. So I asked my union person if they would step in for me and you know, find out what this was about, because you do have a right to ask for that, which I learned in my career, which was really helpful to ask for what these meetings are about. And in the end, I was told that I was being transferred, and so I was on medical leave. I had had to leave my job because I was very sick, and I was told I was not allowed to go back, and that's how it felt. It was so hurtful. And I remember coming to a Wednesday night meeting here, and he was in the group. I remember just crying because it hurt so much, and it was, you know, it was a comfortable place for me to actually be able to say what had happened and how much it had hurt me. Because it was involuntary. It was another form of discrimination. And it was hard because I was also sick. And so I realized that it wasn't a good idea for me to fight it. And so for about a week or two, I sat with it and I didn't respond. You know, I had the email. I knew that was, you know, their decision. And my higher power worked through me and said, you know, let go. Don't resist. And it's funny because one of the gifts of recovery is that my higher power speaks to me in lots of different ways. And one of them is song lyrics. So like it'll pop into my head, or sometimes I'll wake up and a song will be in my head. And I was reading back through some notes from that time just today, because I really didn't prepare for this at all. And so I was reading through that, and my song that popped into my head on May 27th at 3:33 p.m. was, I fought the law and the law won. And like, I don't even know that song. Maybe I know that from like somewhere. It's an old, old song. But anyway, it was like, okay, I know this is not the time to fight. It's only going to make me more sick. And yeah, it gives me goosebumps because, you know, that was my higher power working through me and saying, Erin, okay, let go. And so that was really hard, of course, because I'd put my heart and soul into that job. That was, you know, my externalization of trying to fill the hole within me, my job. And so when I would see people, that's what they would know me as. They'd be like, oh, how's it going at school? Or what are you doing on your break? Or whatever, right? And the gift of recovery has been that I'm not my job. And that's been something that I've been coming to see these last few months. But so June and through the summer, I've been on a grieving process. And when I got that news, I went through the stages of grief. And I knew about those stages of grief because I actually read a book about the stages of grief when my mother's godmother passed away. And that helped me to understand, but I didn't really know. I hadn't really grieved in my life. And so these last few months have been grieving for me. They've been grieving many different things. And, you know, one thing I just had hit me this week. And so that grief is coming out, and that feels really good. So one of the blessings of not resisting and just kind of letting things flow is I decided I'd compile a list of some of the accomplishments that I had achieved in the role that I was in. And, you know, I said it's with something like with heartbreaking something that I that I accept your decision when I replied back in this email. And then I knew that in the weeks to come, once I was able to, I would be going into that classroom and cleaning it out and taking my stuff away and, you know, having that that finalization of kind of saying goodbye. And I'm so glad I had my mom with me to do that because it was hard. My mom and I said the seventh step prayer from the AA Big Book together before we went. I know I did a lot of crying. I cried before we went. It was very hard to see on the door the name of the person who was taking over for me, because the message that had come through my union person was that they didn't know who they were going to get to replace me. And so it was very hurtful to see the person's name on the door. And so that instantly brought up resentment for me. And I didn't know, as I said, until I got to that classroom. So I had some more tears at the classroom, but then it was just kind of get into doing what needed to be done. And I got another gift that day when I closed the door. We had done many, many hauling trips of stuff to my garage. And my mom had already left the building. And I had turned in my key. There was no one else in the building because it was a Friday night. And right before I closed the door, I had turned out the lights and you know, I had sent light and love to all the people in the school and the person taking over, and I really wanted to leave it in a good space. And so what happened was there was this toy train somewhere on a shelf, and it went off and it said, "Woo, woo," as I closed the door. And so there was my higher power at work again, and that meant a lot to me. So I've shared a lot about kind of my life and what I've been going through. I want to share a little bit about the gifts of recovery, because I've kind of said them a little bit along the way, but I guess I should say the woo-woo. I actually looked it up. It means like, well, for me, it was like, thank you. But it was also like the end of a phase in my life. And it was just a beautiful send-off for me. And I just felt loved in that moment. So I should say that as well. For me, the gifts of recovery have been my idea of God has grown big time. I heard someone say that that when we come into the rooms of Al-Anon or 12-step programs, that that the only one sicker than, you know, us there is our God, what we think our God to be. And for me, that was absolutely true. It's like I had started to have a bit more of a relationship with God, but it was like, God, get me a great rock star parking spot, or God, like, I need this in my life. I want more than anything to have health. I want more than anything to have a great love of my life in my life, all this stuff. And so I was asking for things, and living that relationship. But as I said, my higher power has been working through song lyrics, also works through my dreams. So I was reading some of my dream journals yesterday, going back in time, and like those are really meaningful for me to connect that way, because I'm not always open to hearing messages in my living or my waking life. And then the other thing would be synchronicity. So as I said, 333 means something. And for me, I also connect with animals. So when there is an animal that I see, I Google that animal and then I find out information about it. And it always carries a message for me. And it's really uplifting and it's always something positive. And so there are just ways that I relate with my higher power that are different now. And then I guess I should also talk a little bit about my relationship with myself, because that has definitely been something that has grown over time. When we stopped being a part of that dysfunctional family with my mom's ex-boyfriend, I took on the role of berating myself, condemning myself, hurting myself, and what that led to was, of course, food addiction, but numbing myself. And, you know, we didn't talk, we didn't trust, we didn't feel. So when I discovered that I had zits on my face, I didn't know what they were. And so as a young girl, I went into my mom's sewing kit and I took needles. And what I did was I poked my face and poked those zits with needles, and I hurt myself, and that's something that helped me to release some pain. And it was a very dysfunctional way of releasing pain, but it's how I kind of can relate to people who cut or people who, you know, need to let out that pain. And so that was one thing I did. And it's easier to share that now because I've shared it a few times before and I'm not as ashamed of it as I was, but I definitely did some damage to my skin, but I accept myself as I am now. And so my relationship with myself is that, I say to myself, will I love myself for that? So when I go and I squeeze my face, or, you know, I eat too much, or I am angry and I react like defensively towards my mom or whatever it is, those things that trigger the disease in me, I say, will I love myself for that? And that has helped me to gain some really great self-acceptance. Then my journey with my mom, to be in recovery together and to have a support who's walking the same path is just amazing for me. And it's definitely the work of a higher power for us to be in it together, because the first meeting that I actually went to before I went to Al-Anon was an open AA meeting, and met an Al-Anoner there who just, you know, exuded peace and serenity. And so I was like, of course I want to go and have that in my life. And, you know, at that time I was trying to fix myself. I was looking at self-help books. I was, you know, practicing abstinence. I was doing a lot of things that I was trying to manage my life. But really I was at step one. I wasn't doing very well with that. And yeah, my mom and I have this great relationship of honesty and stuff that I thought I would never share with my mom. I've had the gift of being able to share with her, and then they brought out things where she's been able to say, you know, I went through that too. Or she's been able to just identify with me and love me in that moment. With my family, we actually had a couple family members come from Alberta for this past weekend. And I did a lot of detaching, a little bit of setting boundaries, and a lot of accepting who they are. Because it's not easy to be with untreated family members. The effects of the disease are scary, and it's just not easy to accept those in others when they trigger the things in you, and especially the stuff that you haven't worked on. Because for me, relationships are where my character defects come out and where I get to grow the most, because I get to practice, you know, what you teach me in these rooms and in this program. Al-Anon. Al-Anon has been tough for me along the way. It'll be 4 years that I've been attending Al-Anon in January. And Al-Anon was just another place that I could go and I could like apply my idea of life, which is everything is a problem and I need to fix it. So my relationships in Al-Anon have definitely suffered because I've tried to fix or manage or change things. A home group that I was involved in, the group rep had been group rep for 7 years. And I was like, okay, well, we need to have a business meeting. We need to do something about that. And I've had resentments form in Al-Anon, and I've had like my worst character defects come out. And it's been a shameful journey in one sense, because it's something major had happened within this last year where I've been ill. And so it's embarrassing to have conflict, but there is a gift in, recognizing, like practicing an instant step 10, because I was able to apologize after there was a meeting, and, you know, I was taking people's inventory, and I was able to say, you know, I'm sorry for raising my voice. I'm sorry for taking people's inventory. And so I'm not proud of that, but it is something that happens And it's just showing me that it's giving me opportunities for more growth and to do more digging, because what it really did for me is it set me back to step one, even though I had done the steps like 3 times already. And I was like, and then I practiced them like as I did at the beginning of this talk, I practiced them with all of my problems and things that to overcome things. And it sent me back to step one. And so I have been I've had the privilege of being in a group, a study group with two people who accept me as I am and who love me, and we meet once a week. And for me, that meeting has been my safe place. It's a place where those defects can be talked about that are just right there and raw and are not easy to talk about. So I'm very grateful to my two members of my group that that I meet with. Okay. So I just want to talk a little bit about learning about who I am. So when I think about who I am, my ego answers, and, you know, I have dark hair, I'm, you know, my race, I'm my wealth, I'm my job, I'm everything I've done, I'm everything I am, I'm everything I have. And when I cross all of that off the list, what's left for me is there are no differences for me from anyone in this room. And I believe that there's an untouchable essence in each one of us, whether that's, you know, spirit, soul, energy, love, whatever you want to call it. And this is more of who we are than the differences that are in us. And connection for me is happening right now in this 12th step work, you know, carrying the message tonight and having the honor of doing that. And it also happens in meetings where I look and I identify with others. And I really try in meetings to just, instead of seeing the differences, identify and take something away that I connect with each person. And it's a place where I get love and acceptance. And so I have, as you can probably tell, I have a lot of gratitude for this program, because it's definitely changed me. I've been a very sick person, and I've been affected by this disease. And, you know, I still react. I'm not perfect, but I definitely see myself as a spiritual being now, and I see my worth, and I see that goodness in me that's always been there. And so in closing, I'd like to share something I wrote to express my gratitude for the 12th Step Program of Recovery and for the fellowship, which is all of you loving people. So it's a poem, it's not a song. Step by step, you collect me up off the ground from the effects of the disease. Piece by piece, you fill this hole that was shamed in me at 2 years old. You never reject me. You never make me feel bad. You accept me. You love me. Step by step restores my faith that people are kind. And 12th step living is the way. Thank you for carrying the message to me and being there for me, and for all of the gifts I've received in recovery. Thank you.
Thank you. Great job.